Hello and welcome to Field Fisher's Data and Privacy Matters podcast. Today we're going to give you a roundup of the major legal updates from March. I'm Martin, Senior Data Protection Advisor and Field Fisher's Data Protection Officer. And I'm here with Sophia and Christina, and we're all based in Field Fisher's London Tech and Data team.
Hello, I'm Sophia, a solicitor in the Field Fisher Data and Privacy team.
I'm Christina, a solicitor also in the Field Fisher Data and Privacy team.
Firstly, we're going to turn our attention to the latest with AI legislation and regulation. And that's over to you, Sophia.
Thank you, Martin. Regular listeners will be aware that the EU AI Act had its all-important vote in the EU Parliament on the 13th of March, which was approved. This brings the AI Act one step closer to being in force. As those who've closely followed the passing of the GDPR might remember, the Act still needs to have some typographical errors corrected. This is known as the corrigendum process, before being adopted by the Council. After this, it will be published in the official journal and then enter into force 20 days later. With the corrigendum scheduled for the 11th or 12th of April, the AI Act could be enforced by the end of May 2024. In the House of Lords, the private members' bill, AI regulation, has now reached the committee stage. Whilst the success of members' bills are low, the time and attention that this bill is being given does show that there is a concern with how the UK will regulate AI, and the bill calls for a specific AI authority. As we are aware, the impact of AI is a global concern, with a consensus amongst many nations about the security and safety of AI in relation to human rights. The UN General Assembly in March adopted a landmark resolution on the promotion of safe, secure, and trustworthy AI to benefit sustainable development for all. AI is already being used across a number of sectors and industries, especially in recruitment. DSIT, the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology, has published guidance for organisations procuring and deploying AI systems in their recruitment process. This guidance identifies potential ethical risk. It highlights how AI assurance mechanisms can equip organisations with the necessary tools, process and metrics to evaluate the performance of AI system, and how these risks can be managed to ensure compliance with statutory and regulatory requirements.
Thanks for that, Sophia. So it's clear that any organisation creating or adopting AI needs to be mindful about how their AI system complies with existing regulatory landscape and how that will meet forthcoming legislation. And that's maybe a nice segue into a shameless plug for Field Fisher's next AI webinar in our AI privacy webinar series. And that's on AI governance. What is it and what it should never be? And that's on the 17th of April, 4 p.m. BST. And that should greatly assist with all your AI considerations. The invite to sign up for this webinar will be available in the accompanying webpage to this podcast.
Martin, I see that it's not just the AI Act grabbing headlines in the EU either. The Cyber Resilience Act has also been passed in March by the European Parliament. Martin, you're suitably placed to discuss this. Could you tell us a bit more?
Yes, that's right, Christina. The Cyber Resilience Act passed by the EU Parliament now goes to the European Council, and if it's adopted there, it'll follow the similar process of entering into force 20 days after publication in the official journal, although the majority of obligations won't become effective until 3 years after it takes effect. The overall aim of the Cyber Resilience Act is to enhance cybersecurity and cyber resilience within the European Union, and it's part of a bigger picture of regulation in the information sphere when put alongside the AI Act, NIS2, DORA, etc.
And Martin, I'll just stop you there for a second. Before you launch into what the CRA aims to do, could you please expand a little bit on those acronyms you've just cited for those not quite as familiar with the cybersecurity landscape?
Yes, of course, Christina, it is. It's a bit of an acronym soup, isn't it? So NIS2 is the update to the original Network and Information Security Directive. So this is the second iteration of that. And DORA is the Digital Operational Resilience Act, which is aimed at financial regulation and in particular the rules for information and communication technology risks. So the specific aims of the CRA, or Cyber Resilience Act, are to strengthen the cybersecurity of everyday connected products and to tackle vulnerabilities in hardware and software. It impacts products such as smart home assistants, private security cameras, Wi-Fi routers, baby monitors, robot vacuum cleaners, and other Internet of Things devices. The Act places products into different tiers depending on the information security risk, and these tiers inform the corresponding mandatory cybersecurity standards such as, security by design and default, Where have we heard that one before? Unauthorized access prevention, resilience against service attacks, and vulnerability management. And this includes security updates, patching, which should be applied automatically when technically possible. The Act will impact manufacturers, importers, and distributors. And the legal obligations will include all the good things that anyone with a history of GDPR accountability duties will be familiar with: risk assessment, continuous monitoring, reporting, transparency, and so on.
Thanks for that, Martin. It seems to be clear that there's a lot of alignment with the affected stakeholders and the various legislation being enacted in Europe.
Yeah, there's a huge amount going on the regulatory front within Europe in the broad information sphere. And I think with these, you know, particular focuses on security and security risks, it's going to be a very good time to be a security auditor in Europe, I think, in the coming years. So let us now turn our attention to what the ICO has been up to this month. I see, not to be outdone by all the activity in Europe, that the ICO has launched a call for views on consent or pay. Maybe, Christina, could you please tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So in March, we saw the ICO launch a consultation on the hot topic of consent or pay, also known as pay or okay. So by way of a brief reminder, under this model, online services give users the option of either consenting to their data being processed for targeted ads or paying a subscription fee. The debate around this business model has stemmed from Meta's recent move to charge for ad-free Facebook and Instagram services in the EU, a practice that raises questions around informed consent and a clear opt-out option. So consumers, supported by Max Schrems' organization, NOIB, have commented that they don't think that they're actually being given a free choice. Maybe they can't afford to pay a fee, but they feel like leaving the platform isn't really a realistic option for them. So they feel they have no other option but to consent. So as part of their cookie compliance work, the ICO is turning its focus to these pay or okay mechanisms, saying that they understand that businesses want regulatory certainty to help ensure compliance and to, of course, guide their investment decisions.
Thanks, Christina. And so what is the ICO's position and how does that consultation look?
Right. So the ICO has outlined its starting point and what it expects organizations to consider. So it puts out four major factors. To begin with, number one, power balance. So consent can't be freely given if the service provider is a public service or has a position of market power. The second is equivalence. So are the paid for and ad funded services basically the same? The third is appropriate fee. So the consent is unlikely to be freely given if there is an unreasonably high fee. And the fourth is privacy by design. So are the choices presented both fairly and equally? So the ICO's consultation itself is broken into four sections: your views on the ICO's approach, current practice on consent and pay, about you and your organization, and any final comments. So just to note that responses need to be received by 5 p.m. on the 17th of April.
Thanks, Christina. That's really helpful. And our listeners can be assured that we will be monitoring progress on the pay or okay movement, as well as the ICO's consultation on it. Sophia, let's keep with the theme of ad tech and now take a look at the CJEU's decision in the matter of IAB Europe.
Thanks, Martin. So on the 7th of March, the CJEU handed down its judgment in the IAB Europe matter. By way of background, this case started back in 2022. When the Belgian DPA issued a decision against IAB Europe in relation to its transparency and consent framework. As part of the decision, IAB Europe needed to produce an action plan to show how its non-compliance with the GDPR would be remedied. The action plan, which was approved by the Belgian DPA, was put on hold whilst IAB Europe appealed the Belgian DPA's decision to the Belgian Markets Court was settled. The Belgian Markets Court referred questions to the CJEU on whether the TC string constitutes personal data, and if so, what the processing role of IAB Europe is. So the CJEU agreed with the Belgian DPA on two points. Firstly, the TC string does constitute personal data from the perspective of IAB Europe when it can be linked with reasonable means to an online identifier, for example, the IP address of the user's device. And secondly, IAB Europe can be viewed as a joint controller with the other ad tech players in relation to the creation and use of TC strings by publishers and vendors to indicate consent or legitimate interest, but it's not automatically a joint controller for subsequent uses. Subsequent processing in this context means like digital advertising, audience measurement, or content personalization. The exception to this would be if it could be established that IAB Europe has exerted an influence over the subsequent processing.
Thanks. And so what will the actual impact of this decision on the ad tech industry be? And what next steps can we expect?
In terms of the actual impact on the ad tech industry, it has been suggested that since the CJAU didn't explicitly rule against the TC string as a tool, and that the position on the subsequent processing needs to be decided on the facts and in relation to which party or parties is determining the process and means of processing. And given that the regulator has previously signed off on parts of the IAB Europe's action plan to bring its framework into compliance with the GDPR, the ad tech industry will continue to operate with a few changes. So the next step now is for the Belgian Markets Court to hand down its decision on the merits of IAB Europe's appeal against the Belgian DPA's decision. And in the meantime, IAB Europe has indicated that it continues to bring changes to the TCF, which would pave the way towards a TCF version 3, which will address further compliance aspects. However, it does remain to be seen what form these further changes will take.
Thanks, Sophia. Another one where we'll be watching this space, I think. Christina, there was another recent CJEU case that would be interesting to hear about.
Thanks, Martin. Yes, there was. So the CJEU has recently taken a view in OC and European Commission, which is a case related to the indirect identification of a person and anonymization. So in this case, the CJEU took a broad view that for information to be treated as personal data, it's not required that all the information enabling the identification of the data subject needs to be in the hands of one person. The CJEU said that the definition of personal data in the GDPR is one who can be directly or indirectly identified. So the fact that the word indirect is used here demonstrates that not all information which identifies the individual needs to be together with one organization. Where additional information is needed to identify a data subject, it doesn't mean that existing information can't be classified as personal data. Additional information may originate from someone or something other than the data controller.
Thanks for that, Christina. Sophia, before we look at any relevant enforcement action in March, could you please tell us about the ICO's recently published fining guidance?
Absolutely, Martin. This new guidance sets out how the ICO decides to issue penalties and how to calculate fines, and it had been produced following a consultation period. The ICO hopes that the guidance will provide greater transparency to organisations. So the ICO in the guidance gives clarity on what is meant by an undertaking for the purpose of imposing a fine and states that the concept is taken from competition law, which is the UK equivalent provisions to Articles 101 and 102 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union. The CJEU decision C-807/21, paragraph 59, in December 2023, has endorsed this reference to undertaking and competition law with respect to the GDPR. Whilst post-Brexit, the UK is no longer bound by CJEU decisions, the guidance does highlight how the Information Commissioner may have regard to them if the Commissioner considers it appropriate to do so. And what is particularly interesting in the guidance is the granular methodology provided for in the five steps of the penalty process. So this is especially so with the examples given at step 3, which is the calculation of the starting point, which specifies the range of the amount that may be awarded according to the size of the annual turnover and the degree of seriousness of the breach or breaches.
That's really interesting, Sophia, and it makes me think that we can now finally put away our fingers and toes when we're trying to work these things out. I wonder actually how exact someone could be in measuring a potential fine from the ICO in reality.
Yeah, it's interesting. The guidance will certainly give someone with all the details of the seriousness of the breach an indication about how the regulator will react, especially when needed to advise their shareholders. For the independent assessor who's wanting to make a sound estimate, it may be more difficult to determine the aggravating and mitigating factors depending on what information is in the public domain. Either way, the ICO needs to explain and account for its penalty notice, including how any fine has been calculated, which can, of course, be appealed.
Indeed. And speaking of appeals, I noticed that Amazon has appealed the Kniel's fine of 32 million euros with respect to the company's staff monitoring. What enforcement has been happening in the EU, Sophia?
So for me, March 2024 is not the month of the greatest fines, but there have been a few which have caught my eye. The Garante, these days arguably one of the most active regulators, has fined UniCredit Bank 2.8 million euros for alleged insufficient cybersecurity measures to prevent a data breach. This is quite an interesting case on its own, but more so taking into account the various security legislation you mentioned earlier, Martin, as well as the ICO's fining guidance we've just discussed. The short press statement on the Garanti's website states how the bank had not adopted appropriate technical and security measures to counter any cyber attack. Equally, it did not prevent customers from selecting weak PIN numbers, such as sequential numbers or their date of birth. The statement goes on to state how the amount of fine reflected the large number of data subjects involved, the seriousness of the breach, and the financial health of the bank. Adopting corrective measures in a timely fashion, providing information and support to customers, and the fact no banking data was breached were considered mitigating factors. There's another case concerning Finland's DPA and a fine of online retailer Verkko Kauppa for €856,000. The fine was for not defining the retention period of customer data and insisting that the customer had to create an account to make a purchase.
So we know that data retention is an issue that we're often asked about by our clients, and time periods will vary across jurisdictions and depending on the type of data. I think this case further underlines the need to have defined retention periods for personal data rather than holding on to it for an indefinite period of time. Another Scandinavian matter is the Norwegian DPA's fine of the Norwegian Labour and Welfare Administration for approximately €1.7 million, or approximately 20 million Norwegian kroner. I think there are several interesting points about this case, including that the fine is the result of an audit of the Norwegian Labour and Welfare Administration, or NAV, which found that NAV's management system was not privacy compliant, and their approach to the safeguarding of confidentiality via access and log controls were not satisfactory in practice. And this is certainly a reminder for organisations to regularly audit their own data protection practices, whether with internal or external assistance, and fundamentally to ensure that their procedures work in practice and as part of their accountability obligations. And Christina, I'm going to hand over to you now to take a look at the ICO's enforcement.
Thanks, Martin. This past month in March, the ICO ordered Penny Appeal, a charity based in Wakefield, to stop sending unsolicited marketing texts to people without their consent. Penny Appeal sent more than 460,000 unsolicited texts over a 10-day period to 52,000 people who had either never provided their consent in the first place or who had clearly opted out. So I'll save you all from doing the math on that. So this equates to around 9 texts to each individual. So over a 10-day period, let's say that's roughly a text a day. These texts had been sent to coincide with Ramadan back in 2022, encouraging people on a daily basis to donate to the charity's appeals. This resulted in over 350 complaints to the ICO, who had been actually engaging with the charity since 2020 after receiving complaints about a similar marketing campaign. The ICO has now issued an enforcement notice, ordering Penny Appeal to stop sending marketing communications without consent within 30 days. The ICO turned this into a wider reminder to all charities that, despite their charity status, they still have to abide by their legal obligations. So while not a charity, it is also worth mentioning that there was another ICO enforcement action that occurred in March, which was an £80,000 fine for a predatory spam call campaign by Pinnacle Life. The company made nearly 48,000 illegal calls over the span of a year, during which the company attempted to sell their life insurance products. So Martin, it's interesting because these marketing campaigns also remind me of the ICO taking action against HelloFresh this past January for sending millions of spam emails and texts to customers. For both HelloFresh and the more recent Penny Appeal action, I think it's good to note that many of the complaints were received by Mobile UK's spam reporting service, also known as the 7726 spam reporting service, which is a number that mobile customers using UK networks can text to report unwanted SMS messages or phone calls on a mobile. So for our listeners, 7726 was chosen because it actually spells spam on an alphanumeric phone keypad, which is quite a handy way of remembering it.
Indeed it is, Christina. Thanks for that. It is fascinating to note how the ICO is providing communications to sectors like here to the charity sector, as you've just outlined, or to all, as it has done with its cookie information, arguably, you know, trying to give fair and full warning to everyone to get their data protection compliance in order. And besides fines, have we seen any other enforcement action from the ICO in March, Sophia?
We have indeed, Martin. I'll start with a reprimand by the ICO to both Dover Harbour Board and Kent Police in relation to information sharing. So firstly, I'll just provide a reminder as to why the ICO is issuing reprimands. This is in line with the ICO's public sector approach to not impose large fines for public sector organisations, given that the fine imposed is paid for out of the public purse and ultimately reduces the budget for vital services. The cause of the reprimand in these cases was due to employees using WhatsApp and/or Telegram messaging services to share information without appropriate safeguards in place. With respect to Dover Harbour Board, the ICO also pointed out how its data protection training was insufficient for operational policing purposes. There was no risk assessment in place and a lack of safeguards in how the message group was managed. The ICO reported how Dover Harbour Board has since provided officers with further data protection training and how the ICO has recommended the organisation reviews its data protection policies.
Interesting, yet another accountability in action piece there. So we're seeing the range of the ICO's enforcement powers. First a fine, followed by reprimands, and I think you're going to finish with an enforcement notice.
I am. That's absolutely correct, Martin. So the ICO issued the Home Office with an enforcement notice and a warning for failing to evaluate the privacy risks posed by the electronic monitoring of migrants arriving in the UK. The infringement concerned the Home Office's pilot to place ankle tags on and then track the GPS location of up to 600 migrants who, after arriving in the UK, were on immigration bail. And whilst this pilot ended in December 2023, the Home Office has kept the GPS location data collected by the tags that it can readily access, and the Home Office will share this with third parties. The Home Office was ordered to update its internal policies, including its access guidance and privacy information, with respect to the retained data from the pilot.
Many thanks, Sophia. So there we go. Yet another podcast episode packed with reminders about new legislation to be aware of and to start planning to integrate, regulator consultations to take part in, and guidance to consider, as well as enforcement action that provides relatable reminders of what not to be doing and how to ensure your data protection compliance meets regulatory standards. And whilst we're now used to data protection being front and centre, reports that staff at the London Clinic tried to access the Princess of Wales's medical records has put data protection in the UK into another stratosphere. The ICO itself, when confirming that it has received notification about the breach, published a set of Q&As to further explain the issues here and the possible consequences for any employee found to have accessed someone's medical records without cause or consent. And that's all we have time for this month. Thank you for joining us for this roundup of key legal updates on the Fieldfisher Data and Privacy Matters podcast. If you have any questions about today's updates, of course, don't hesitate to contact us. And if you find it useful, do make sure to give us a like or review on your podcast channel of choice. As always, thanks for taking the time to listen. Thanks, Sophia and Christina, for joining today.